The following message is copyrighted by Westminster Theological Seminary. Duplication, distribution, or other use of all or any part of this message is not permitted without prior written consent. Please direct your inquiries to communications@wts.edu. For all other information, please visit the main website at www.wts.edu.
I think
that would be then the starting point for all other discussion.
Right.
The other way around. We can talk about this, but.
Yeah. Well, these authors, I take it from the way this particular section is composed and from the general feeling, are committed to the Kuyperian approach that says that every part of creation and certainly every discipline should have a possibility to be worked out under the lordship of Christ. And they don't mean by that that you should just be a good Christian, be an honest person, and also a carpenter, a plumber, whatever. They mean by that there are Christian implications. There is a worldview implication of every single profession, down to the most technical, specialized thing. And I think that's one of the reasons that they encourage this grouping together, it's because of that particular commitment. And I believe that. I think that's right. However, your question, I think, was put in the correct way. Where do you begin? I think you have a theological consideration. You have a cultural consideration. In a culture where the major emphases have not necessarily been placed there, nurtured, developed by Christians, you're going to be dealing with a context which is very ambiguous when you're working out your Christian principles. Christians may be very far behind the game in thinking some of these things through. You mentioned, the epistemological or cognitive studies. Christians are probably way behind in those areas, at least in looking at the physiological aspects of them and so forth, the organic nature aspects of them. They may be less behind in other kinds of medical things, but it's important, while keeping the Kuyperian view, not to be naive and to think that just because you become the Christian Medical Society or Christian Nurses Association or whatever it is, you're going to go faster than cultural realities will allow. So I would say where to begin is by working as Christians on these things, having all kinds of ways to suggest moving ahead. But for many, at the same time, it will not involve banding together with full-blown institutions. It'll involve working with already existing institutions, which will have a secular character. And simply because our culture is not defined enough as a Christian thing that you would want with confidence to start doing a full-blown institution. I mean, and I think the history of people who start Christian universities and Christian institutions with the appearance of age, full-blown, with a lot of money, shows the dangers inherent in this kind of thing. I mean, people can raise millions of dollars and create a Christian university out of whole cloth. And I had a friend when I was in college. I had a friend who was head of the psychiatry people at the University Health Services, and he taught at the medical school as well at Harvard. And a Christian university was created. I won't mention the name because you'd all know it. But it was created with a lot of money. And one of the main ambitions of this person who created the university was to have the best medical school in the country. And they invited my friend to be chief of the staff or some big position in this medical school, just to come and be it, And he was really torn. I mean, we talked about this for hours. On the one hand, he just loved the idea of being in a Christian environment, and also he was given all this money. He could do almost anything he wanted, you know. On the other hand, he realized that he was already in a place that was pretty advanced, and he'd give up that fellowship, that community, those opportunities. He'd give up, you know, that kind of position, and he'd be going with people who may or may not have much understanding of what science is all about, what technology is all about, and so forth. You don't just create a Christian research culture overnight. It just can't be done. The nature of culture is to be slow and deliberate. So he finally decided not to do it, although it was an agonizing decision. As far as I know, they got the place going without him, and did, you know, they found other people, and I don't know whether it's turned out to be a good place or not. I really don't know. But that is a danger. I found their treatment of this problem a little bit vague. Like on page 115, it says, things like, this issue is complicated when one has trouble understanding the alternative positions without stereotyping them, and when one feels a professional and Christian loyalty to help, within limits, others be loyal to their own convictions. While maintaining one's own integrity, one must nurture the integrity of others and not use their vulnerability to influence them unduly. Still, one of the most important ways Christian medical professionals can serve God's cause is by striving as individuals to integrate their professional identities and services with their Christian callings. Great. Who could argue with that? What does it mean? You know, what do you do? I think you got to go beyond that to say, well, where do I go to medical school? What do I specialize in? Where's the most useful place of my service in order to bring this thing forward? All right. But this notion of calling is then a very, very crucial one. And as I said at the beginning, I believe it's one of the two or three hottest issues, should be, on the Christian agenda. And it could go a long way to answering just the question that Don raised by dealing with calling a little more. Yeah.
I have just one more comment.
Fine.
Discussing my own question, I'd like to say that a medical profession is possible.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think we have to be very critical. At the same time, and uncover some of the root problems, because it's part of our mission to save the oppressed from victimization. Yet at the same time, I think it's important to work positively in a calling, and work out how this should be done from a Christian perspective, so that we're not only in the position of denouncing, but also of proclaiming. And that's often the harder thing to do. I mean, both are hard, but it's even harder to say, okay, this, what you're doing here is manipulative and unethical. What would you suggest in its place, and how would you work? And you know, this is. I think that's a part of our comportment that needs to be stressed. Okay, I don't think we need to spend a lot of time on what they call the character of relationships in medicine. They opt for the covenant character as opposed to contract and so forth. I think these are all things that Christians need to be aware of and need to think of. But things that I think most of us are pretty well agreed upon. I would like to go on to the section on technology, tragedy, and so forth, and then if we have any more time, a little bit more about cost. We've done some on cost, but we could do a little more. But I really want to go on to this whole question of technology. Let me first say that technology, of course, is not a medical problem. It's a global cultural problem. Technology has a particular impact on the medical profession, obviously, but this is a global problem. And let me say, as I did for calling, that the consideration of technique to use Elul's distinctive term. And the study of technique should be very high on our ethical and apologetics agenda, since it's one of the great features of the Western and increasingly the non-Western world as well, the modern world. So great feature of modernity. Because of its pervasive claims on all of life, there are a number of very special temptations which I think we fall into. All right, let me give you the two extreme ones, and then I'd like to say that there's a third way. I mean, the first temptation would be to say that technology is the savior, and nobody would actually come out and say it like that, except Julian Huxley or somebody. But there are a lot of subtle ways to think of technology as the savior. I believe that one of the reasons that we have such moral promiscuity, and perhaps one of the reasons for the some of the dreadful diseases that we have, such as the AIDS disease or AIDS-related diseases and so forth, is because of a kind of arrogance in trusting that technology can save us. Now, I mean, we're not hoping the technology will get us out of this thing, but we got into it because I think partly we thought, hey, I can behave any way I want, because we've got the technique to avoid problems. Obviously abortion is an example of this, some kinds of abortion. But so is a lot of contraception, and then the ability to quickly terminate a disease once it begins gives you an illusion of freedom. You know, I can, because it can be done with safety, then I can do it. Let alone whether it's right or wrong. So there are lots of ways of trusting technology, and this raises all kinds of issues which we want to hit on. One of them is that you can confuse technology with the thing that helps, and forget that it's a tool. The word comes from Greek word for hand. It's the extension. It's not the thing itself. And there are many stories about medical people who go to places which don't have a lot of technique, and who are counterproductive because they simply bring in a hypodermic needle, which is efficient, but which doesn't take care of the whole person. And everyone knows the missionary doctor who goes and there's an epidemic of some kind, and a few visits with a hypodermic needle to various families would probably wipe this thing out. And so he suggests that, and the people go into complete confusion and upheaval, because first of all, a needle with a liquid represents something very, very strange in that culture. Second of all, the idea of curing a physical disease without taking into account the larger setting, who sent the mosquito, that carried the parasite, and what have I done to deserve this, and all those things, which, may or may not be right, but it's there, is confusing. So there's a lot of dimensions to the over-trust of technique, and as we know as Christians, that technology will not sort of save us. The other extreme is the extreme that I think Elul himself represents, and that is, therefore, to be suspicious of all technology, to reject technology as such, and to think that freedom can only come by getting around it or living with it as a necessary evil, but concentrating on other things. And this, a lot of people have this particular view. all the back to nature movements, as well as some of the health food things, and just a lot of subtle ways in which we feel that if we could only do without wires and different kinds of buttons and things, we would be natural and therefore better. This too is an extreme, because scripturally, the use of technique is something good. It's something God has given us. He wants us to develop the world by the use of tools. This is perfectly all right. And in the Bible, there's a lot of approbation of various kinds of tools and so on, and that's considered part of the cultural mandate. And so we find ourselves in a difficult position between two extremes, espousing a sort of third way. And sometimes it's very difficult to know what that third way is. Think of, again, the option of using very expensive, very sophisticated techniques that might, in a particular case, preserve someone's life for a week or two. What do you do? We don't reject technique, so we're tempted by this, and after all, the person might be saved. But we don't trust it because it won't keep the person alive forever. So, you know, how do you decide? These people discuss that kind of decision in terms of the story, and here's where they introduce their story ethics. And the first story, or the basic story they talk about, is tragedy, or they call it the sad story. And then the second one they introduce is the Christian tradition, or the Christian story. Now, the sad story is put in terms of Bacon, Francis Bacon's view, which many people would say is a key step towards the creation of modern science. He made the affirmation that we never talk about being overmastered by disease, by producing diseases incurable. Because he maintained that would not only sanction a kind of laziness and neglect, but it would also feed ignorance and so on. And he says that these authors say that this particular perspective, that no disease is incurable, has shaped medical profession, and perhaps introduced an undue note of optimism into medical technology, and one which has its own problem of ignoring what they call the sad story. And you need to know the sad story in order to have the most balanced use of technology. So they talk about technology and the flawed hero. And this I hope we can discuss a little bit. As you probably know, the whole discussion of heroism in modern ethics is very strong. We're getting away from simply just cold categories of this is right, this is wrong, regulation and articles and bylaws and so forth, and we're getting into the story which McIntyre and others have set forth, and the story often has a hero or a villain. And so the idea in the ethical story of the use of technology is that the doctor and the nurse are heroes, and they are involved in a heroic battle against death and disease. And because life itself is good, and we discussed that last time, therefore, this heroic fight to preserve it or to choose it is good. And that kind of hero is what the ethics of medical technology promotes. On the other hand, they would say this hero has to be modified. He or she is a flawed hero. And they say that the fight against death or disease has to be mitigated by the Christian knowledge that this life is not all there is, and that technology will not save us out of everything. And they mention a film, and I'd thought about showing you this film, but it's a little dated now. I think I'll just tell you about it. And maybe some of you know this. It was around 15, 20 years ago on the public television circuit. A Canadian film called Whose Life Is It Anyway? And it's a hospital room drama of about 2 hours. And it's a man, an artist, I guess he's a sculptor, who has a terrible accident, and he becomes quadriplegic. And he can only be kept alive by artificial means. And the film is a drama about the good nurse against the bad doctor. The good nurse sympathizes with the patient who wants to let his life go and get off of the artificial means of living and so forth, and not have whatever medicine it is that would keep him going. And the bad doctor, because he feels that technology is available and that his name would be made good, wants to save this person. And the debate goes on throughout the movie, and finally at the end, a lawyer is brought in, or a judge is brought in, and they have a brief trial right there in the room. And through a very strange application of the writ of habeas corpus, the judge declares that the patient does not have to stay alive, that he is allowed to refuse the treatment, and he does, and a few days later he dies, and so on. Now, this film caused a big stir because it villainized the doctor, which is something that hasn't been done a lot before. Usually the doctors are heroes. And it also raised the huge question of, shouldn't you preserve life at all costs? However, it was a pretty one-sided film, because it was so obvious that the doctor was on an ego trip, and this man, Harrison, was just this wonderful, sensitive artist who had all the dimensions worked out about why it wasn't worth living this way, and this nurse kind of fell in love with him, and I mean, it was all very dramatic. It did raise the question about how far one should go in trying to preserve life, whether technology, in a very subtle way, doesn't encourage us to go beyond what we should. So I would like to hear your comments on this section. Is it true that the doctor should be a flawed hero, one who does what they can, but won't deny the Christian view of the sad story? What did you think of this section? Does the quadriplegic refusing dialysis is that case sufficiently clear to determine the issue of who should decide? Let me put it another way. Is the availability or non-availability of technology enough to determine the issue of you know, who should decide? does the Christian doctrine of freedom help us with this whole issue of the extent of using technology? Does the is there an obvious answer about the role of the doctor in all this? What is the doctor's role in the decision to use technology, either to preserve life or to add a dimension to it or whatever? Is the doctor's knowledge of the technology with the doctor's moral commitments, whatever they might be, a sufficient factor to determine the ethical outcome of, you know, whether it's the Harrison case or another case? And the cases are so diverse. I mean, it's an unfair question the way I raised it. Let me ask you one that's a lot clearer, and they raise it here. You know, in the Jehovah's Witness religion, blood transfusions are refused because of a very strange interpretation of a couple of verses in the Pentateuch, which say the life is in the blood, and then sort of say that you should not confuse your life with the life of another, and that, you know, you shouldn't wear somebody else's clothes and all these things. And so they won't have a transfusion. All right. Does the ability, the technical ability to save a dying Jehovah's Witness decide what should happen to that dying Jehovah's Witness despite their, you know, their wishes? Let me ask this question. Let me push this and give another case, which is even more pointed. A teenager comes into the emergency room, having taken a huge bottle of barbiturates or some kind of pill with the intention of suicide. And has left a note saying, "Please, whoever finds me, don't try to do anything to save me." Okay, what's the hospital's responsibility? Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's one consideration. Of course, in the case of a person, an elderly person who is, you know, who's had a cardiac arrest and so forth, and the only chance of resuscitation might turn them into a vegetable, there is, these living wills specify that they don't want that, and the hospital is not required to do that. The law requires that a hospital save a suicide person, because suicide's against the law. It's a crime. Our kids used to laugh at that. Oh, you can punish it with it. But, yeah, right. And I think that's a very good point. It seems to me that although we do want to move perhaps closer than we were in the 50s or so to patients' rights, we don't want to move towards patients' rights so hard that we forget that the state and the magistrates, as well as the doctors, have ethical responsibilities towards you, which you may not have towards yourself. You may be far more careless about your own life than the state is, which is reflecting God's care for you, or should be anyway. And so getting a court order for a 17-year-old, in my judgment, would be a perfectly legitimate approach, because you care for that person's life more than they do. Let's say that we disagree with the Jehovah's Witness view on transfusions, we care for their life more than they do. It's a tricky thing, but you've got to consider that technology here is not capable to decide one way or another. It might help you to make some predictions, which, based on which you may make certain choices. Like, you have, when you get to terminal choices, you have to make some guesses about the person's chance of recovery. And depending on, you know, what the chance is and what your views are, of course, you'll make certain decisions. But technology, oh my, technology cannot in itself tell you what to do. You've got to base that on higher principle. And the principle, I would say, has to be higher than the individual choice. And I feel we're moving in our culture in reaction to arbitrary, perhaps, ethics. We're overreacting towards personal rights. And not only are the individuals often not competent to make certain decisions just on a technical level, but they're also, they shouldn't make decisions that regulate society and the higher goals of individual callings based on what God says, which are reflected in the civil law and in the moral codes of doctors. And this film was so unfair. When I used to show this in my ethics class where I taught before, because it's so seductive. You start feeling so sorry for the patient, and you just think this doctor is just a villain. He's on an ego trip trying to save him, and just leave him alone. You know, and you don't realize that your own sensitivity to that person's life and integrity is being sapped as you get into this attitude. Maybe the doctor was on an ego trip, but he's signed the Hippocratic Oath and he's trying to help. And there is a point to the crazy law about suicide, and that is that suicide's a crime because no one has a right to take their own life, because life is more important than individual rights to do that. So the flawed hero idea is, I think, okay. I find it a slightly odd way of putting it. And tragedy is more than a sad story. It's sin and death. And the Christian story reverses that, to be sure. But it seems to me your ethical norms have to determine the outcome, and that regulates the use of technology. Which in itself is perfectly good. Okay, well, we'll have to stop there. Next time, as I say, please, if you would do the reading, get yourself a week ahead, because I'm having a little trouble getting my person here. And if I succeed, then we'll go right on back onto the schedule. But this stuff is really important, birth control and genetic engineering. We're moving into a new phase, so do read that. And I'll see if I can set up what I had originally intended.